astronaut and Caribou native Jessica Meir. It was just a year ago, last October, that astronauts Jessica Meir and Christina Cook made history after completing the first all-female spacewalk outside the International Space Station. Since then, Meir has received a lot of attention, well-deserved. She's been named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People and has been in demand as a speaker and role model. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Jessica Meir is our guest. We'll talk to her about her life, her journey from Aroostook County to space, what it was like to do a spacewalk, what kinds of experiments she conducted on the International Space Station, and what might be next for her. What have you always wanted to ask an astronaut? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm your host, Jennifer Rooks. Today, Jessica Meir joins us. She is a NASA astronaut and grew up in Caribou, Maine. She spent 6 months on the International Space Station and made history as part of the first all-female spacewalk outside of the ISS. She has been back on Earth since April. We welcome your questions and comments for Jessica. Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Jessica Meir, as I read that, I realized in all the years I've hosted this program, I've never said somebody has been back on Earth since a certain time. Just one of those fun things that you get to say.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be talking to everybody in Maine today.
Jessica Meir, I want to talk to you so much about your experience on the International Space Station and your reflections about life since then, especially coming back during a pandemic. But let's start earlier than that. I understand that you have wanted to be an astronaut since you were a little girl in Caribou, Maine. What gave you the idea? When did you make this decision?
Well, my mom says that I first started saying it when I was 5 years old up in Caribou, and my first memory was in first grade when we were asked to draw a picture of what we wanted to be when we grew up. And I remember distinctly drawing an astronaut on the surface of the moon, standing next to the flag, that iconic kind of image like we all saw from the Apollo missions. And I never really stopped saying it since then.
What do you think it was? Why did that capture your imagination then? And what gave you the persistence to stick with this really, really difficult dream?
Well, I wish that I had one event or one specific moment to capture, because, of course, I get asked this quite a bit. But I think it was a combination of factors for me. Growing up in Caribou, you know, a lot of great nature and trees and forests around. And I think I was naturally curious about the world around me and really wanted to explore more about the plants and the animals and nature. And I think probably also a bit attributed to my mom. She's Swedish, and Swedes tend to have a pretty close connection to nature. So I think all of those things really drove this curiosity about the world around me and for exploration. Maybe it had something to do with how incredible the stars are in northern Maine. You know, pretty special view we have of the night sky up there without light pollution. And of course, that was something that I simply took for granted as a kid, since I didn't know that it wasn't that way everywhere. And then I think, you know, in the 80s and 90s, when I was growing up, the space shuttle program was very active, and it was always on the evening news. You know, we didn't have the internet to search and find all kinds of different types of information. We really got our news by the newspapers or the radio or the evening news, and the space shuttle program was really highlighted quite a bit. So I think something to do with a combination of those events must have put that idea in my head. My brother likes to say that it was his idea first, so who knows? Maybe it was his Lego sets that inspired me, but some kind of combination of all those things seemed to do the trick.
Well, we're having this conversation in October. This time last year, you were on the International Space Station. You had just completed an historic walk, you and Christina Cook, the first all-female spacewalk outside the International Space Station. I could spend the entire hour asking you about what it was like to be on a spacewalk. But my understanding is that the spacewalk that you made history with wasn't even planned, right?
Yes, that's right. We were planned to do a spacewalk at that time, Christina and I together. We were in the middle of doing some spacewalks to upgrade the power channel. So basically replacing some old batteries with some newer lithium ion batteries as a standard space station upgrade. And those spacewalks started right when I arrived on the space station. And Christina and I were scheduled to perform the third one in the series together. But after those first two spacewalks, something went wrong with this unit called the BCDU, the Battery Charge Discharge Unit. So basically, it's this box that is in charge of relaying the power from the solar panels to the batteries and then discharging from the battery. So really a vital component of the power system for the space station. So in the end, we didn't end up doing, for that first spacewalk, we didn't do the planned spacewalk to just replace batteries. Instead, we actually had to remove and replace that BCDU unit. And it was then kind of this contingency spacewalk. We needed to do it quickly. And so it wasn't something that we were completely prepared for since we had been preparing for the other spacewalk. But luckily, given the way our incredible training program is here on the ground for spacewalk training, we have all of the skill set and we know how to use the tools. We have a common set of tools for these interfaces. So that interactions with the hardware and really the operations that we were going to be doing, even though we hadn't practiced and planned through it all, they were very similar to some of the things that we had experience with. So we had about 48 hours to prepare for that one, and then we went out the hatch to do our job that day.
So when you went out the hatch for the first time, tell me what that felt like.
It's a simply incredible feeling and one that I'll certainly never forget. Those three spacewalks that I conducted were really a highlight of the mission. You know, it was almost another dream in a dream come true. And when you first come out of the hatch, on the first spacewalk, I was in the second one out of the hatch. And when you come out of that position, you come out feet first. So I'm looking down at my boots and we came out in when the Earth was lit up. So we came up when there was light. Sometimes, you know, you might come out during dark, one of the dark cycles, but we were in the light cycle. And so I came out and I saw my boots hanging down and then nothing in between my boots and the Earth below. And it's really interesting because you get more of that sense of motion of how quickly we're moving past the Earth when you're outside the station like that. You know, when you're inside looking out a window, I think with the whole structure and all of the equipment and, you know, being inside that large volume, you don't feel that sense of motion as much as you do when you're outside just in your spacesuit. And the colors even look brighter and more intense. And it is just simply such an extraordinary feeling looking down at this beautiful gem below you and knowing that you are one of the few people that are not on that planet right now. It's really a pretty intense feeling, and it certainly is life-changing. But then you really need to get focused and get going with the job at hand. Spacewalks are certainly the riskiest thing that we do as astronauts and also the most challenging both mentally and physically. So it really does demand all of your focus to make sure that you conduct operations successfully to get the job done, and then also with safety being the utmost first priority.
So how fast are you going when you're doing a spacewalk? You said you get a sense of how fast you're moving. How fast is that?
Right. So you're still moving at the same speed that you are when you're inside the space station. So because of the altitude of the space station, it's up at about 250 miles above the Earth. The orbit that we're in means that we are moving at about 17,500 miles per hour. So pretty quickly, fast enough to cover the entire planet every 90 minutes. And you get more of that sense of motion when you can just really see the Earth directly below you.
But you can't feel it because there's not the kind of wind that there is on Earth, obviously.
That's right. And there's no relative motion between you and the space station. So if you look down and you see it, it's almost more like one of these, like an optical illusion or a visual sensation than it is the feeling of that you are moving. But just the same as if you're driving in a car, right? You don't actually feel that sense of motion relative because of the speed and the relative motion between you and the car.
Your that first spacewalk was more than 17 hours. Does that 17 hours fly by, or does it go by slowly because every single thing you do is so important?
So the spacewalk, the first one was about just over 7 hours.
Oh, I'm sorry. 7 hours, 17 minutes. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Still.
And you are in the suit for longer than that because there are several hours where you're just getting ready in the suit and going through all the safety protocols to decompress the hatch and get you out safely. So you're actually in the suit for much longer than the 7 hours. But it actually does go by quite quickly because of this intense focus that you have throughout the entire thing. You know, you feel the sense of time a little bit. You know, it really depends on the specific spacewalk that you're doing too, how busy you are, what kind of operations that you're doing. But yes, for me, it did go by pretty quickly.
And you did 3 spacewalks in all, you said?
Yes, that's right. And that wasn't enough. I wish I could have done more, but doing 3 is actually pretty lucky. Normally, during a 6-month mission, sometimes people don't have any spacewalks. Sometimes people usually have more like 1 or 2 in that period. So we were on the space station during a particularly busy time in terms of spacewalk operations. So we did more than the average expedition on the space station, but that was fine with us because we all really loved it.
Oh, my goodness. Tell me about some of the experiments you were doing on board the space station. Really interesting, and from what I've read.
Yes. So the prime focus of the International Space Station, now that it's fully built, is science. It is a national lab, and we are doing all kinds of scientific experiments, ranging from physiology and medicine, so how the spaceflight environment affects our human bodies. And of course, we are the subjects of those experiments. So things looking at differences in the cardiovascular system, changes to our blood vessels, potential changes to our eyes. That's one of the hot topics of concern lately, since some astronauts have come back with some anatomical differences to the back of their eye, and we want to make sure that we fully understand that to make sure that we can keep astronauts safe. We do experiments for combustion. So even flames burn differently in space without hot air rising, without gravity, and then you don't have convection. So even flames will burn differently, and those experiments have applications toward better fuel efficiency for vehicles back on Earth, as well as future spacecraft propulsion systems. We do protein crystal growth experiments. So protein crystals can grow larger and more pure in space without gravity. And those experiments have a lot of applications for pharmaceutical research. If you can grow and identify and study the characteristics of this protein, then you might be able to design a therapy to inhibit something on that protein for a certain disease state. So things like Alzheimer's, cancer, there's currently a drug that is undergoing clinical research trials from a Japanese study that was done recently on the space station for Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. So that's one of the really interesting things about the work that we do at NASA and in space. We have kind of this tagline, it's really true, off the Earth for the Earth, because all the experiments that we're doing have applications not only for future space exploration, but also for real tangible benefits and states, disease states, different applications technology-wise on Earth, several different spin-off technologies and even direct applications toward life back here on Earth. So incredibly exciting stuff. And there's so many more experiments, radiation experiments, material science experiments. We did several cell biotech type experiments where we were looking at bone cells and the effect of microgravity, where we were growing small miniature heart muscles to see what happens with the differences in contractility of that mini heart muscle in space. And that's something, although we've studied the cardiovascular system quite a bit, we haven't really studied it at the tissue level. So lots of insights there, again, for future space exploration and astronaut health, but also for medical states back on Earth. We did experiments with mice, looking at things like the influence of circadian rhythms on liver disease. Another one, which was a really cool experiment and has actually already been published in PNAS, we were doing experiments with mice looking at the myostatin pathway. And myostatin is actually an inhibitor for muscle growth, a normal part of your body to help keep all of your homeostasis, all of your muscle system in check. And if you take out this gene and you don't have that inhibitor, what these researchers have found, so we flew basically what we call these mighty mice, really interesting experiment where we had these myostatin knockout mice, also had a control group, of course, and then we had another group where we were delivering a therapy that was basically accomplishing the same kind of thing as knocking out part of that myostatin pathway. End result being these mice actually retained and had much larger muscle mass than the controls and also were able to maintain their bone density throughout that mission. So really important when you start thinking about long-duration missions in order to keep our bones and muscles healthy for these space missions, but also for disease states like osteoporosis and several other bone and muscle degenerative states. So as you can see, as a scientist, I love talking about the science, and there's so many interesting experiments that we're doing. There's a great application that you can download on your phone or go to the NASA website called Space Station Research Explorer. You can search more about specific disciplines and topics and experiments and learn a lot more about them.
I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, what is the future here? You're talking about protein crystals that grow more purely in space. Do you foresee a day in which, as part of a pharmaceutical company, a space lab may be part of what they own and operate?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, right now we're more kind of at the stage of a test bed for those types of technologies, but that potential certainly does exist. Another great example of something like that is another facility that we had on board that we did several experiments with during my mission, and it's called the biofabrication facility. And that is still a technology demonstration right now, but it has the potential to actually grow organs in space. So it's basically using cells to print tissue, like a 3D printer for human tissue. And this is a really interesting application because, as you may be aware, there's constantly a lack. There are never enough organs for organ transplant procedures for patients on Earth. So there have been several efforts on the ground to make artificial organs. How could we do that in a lab so that we could have more organs for these types of replacement procedures? One of the problems on Earth is that with gravity, you need to have some kind of scaffolding, some kind of support structure to help those cells form large enough tissue layers and then to an eventual organ. The problem is these support structures then need to be removed and or can be toxic to the cells themselves. So it's been a problem doing that on the ground. The hypothesis here is that without gravity, you would be able to grow these layers of tissue thick enough in order to actually form an organ. So the idea is that maybe one day we could actually be 3D printing organs in space that could then be used for organ transplant procedures on Earth. So pretty cool kind of science fiction-y type stuff, but we're actually doing those kind of experiments already.
That's so exciting. We're speaking with Jessica Meir, the astronaut who grew up in Caribou, Maine, and spent 6 months, is it, on the International Space Station and took part in 3 spacewalks. Jessica, since you've been back, you have been called upon for speaking engagements. You've been named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People. How do you view your role now that you're back on Earth?
You know, it's a really interesting process, and I spoke about this in another interview yesterday when people were talking about mentors and role models, and it's a really interesting process to realize when you're kind of on the other side of that. You know, all these people that you've aspired to and looked up to in your life, and for me, that was the biggest one, was always this blue flight suit. It was this iconic image of an astronaut that I had dreamed about my entire life, and I remember feeling that back in 2013 when I was selected to be an astronaut and put on that blue flight suit for the first time, or when I'm giving a talk to a group of school kids and I suddenly have to look back and take a step back and look toward me and think, wow, I'm the person on the other side now in that blue flight suit. And it is really interesting. It's an interesting process because you have to kind of realize that you're suddenly on that other side and how important it is to then become that mentor and give back to everybody that helped you. You know, all the school systems in Maine and all of my mentors all throughout the process were absolutely a pivotal part in that trajectory for me. And so now I think it's really my obligation and duty to give back in any way that I can.
How do we get more girls interested in science and science careers?
Well, I think we're certainly headed in the right direction. You know, Christina and I, it was that first all-female spacewalk that was a historic milestone. And if you think about that, for me, it was really this multifaceted approach where in the beginning, because Christina and I, when we were selected as astronauts in 2013, our class was actually 50% male and 50% female. And that was the first time that that had happened in the astronaut office. I think it's just shows us that we're trending in the right direction. And so for Christina and I, we went through the exact same training program as all of our female and male counterparts. Everybody was held to the same standard. So for us, you know, part of it going out the hatch that day was just us doing our jobs. It didn't matter who we were going out with. But I think the important thing that I was able to reflect a little bit more about after the fact was that it is a very important historical achievement to note because of the fact, not necessarily for me or Christina, for our personal achievements, we really did feel like we were just doing our job that day. But the generations of women and other minorities that really were the boundary pushers, the ones that were pushing the envelope and breaking those glass ceilings before us to enable us to be there that day, they're the ones that we hope to really pay tribute to. It's really an homage to them. Our success is really owed to them. And so for me, you know, I didn't look at it as a personal achievement. I looked at it as that they are the ones that should truly be reveling in what they did. And so I think that, you know, we're going in the right direction. And I think we need to continue to do these kind of events for people like me in these positions. If you can, you know, I think it's always more effective and inspiring when somebody can see something in them that reminds them, or they can have something in common with. So if it's the fact that I'm a woman or the fact that I grew up in a small town in Maine, I think that all of these things can be very important in people realizing that their dreams can also come true. It makes people a little bit more real when they have something in common to connect to. So I think by continuing to do outreach and inspire and just make it more normal, you know, seeing the fact that we have so many female astronauts, the fact that Christina and I are out there doing spacewalks, I think that kind of thing, just seeing that full integration will, I think, inspire kids because they'll look at us, they'll look at the astronaut office or whatever profession they're interested in, and they'll see men and women working side by side on all these things. And my true hope is that it is just normal, that we don't need to pay attention anymore to the first all-female anything because it is just a normal part of the way that we do things.
And speaking to that, as we go to a break, I will read a post from Rebecca on Facebook who writes, "My toddler daughter begged to be an astronaut for Halloween, so we took the opportunity to not just teach her more about that, but also about Jessica Meir. Now she says she wants to be Jessica Meir." So there you go. You have at least one Halloween toddler. I am going to go to a break. When we come back, we'll come to some more of your questions and comments for astronaut Jessica Meir. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Otelco Cloud and Managed Services, helping Maine businesses manage IT systems and business communication. Learn more at otelco.com.
Hi, I'm Carol Off.
And I'm Jeff Douglas.
Every day, As It Happens connects you with stories in the news by connecting with the people connected with those stories.
For nearly 50 years, we have done that using one simple tool, the telephone.
Whether the story is political, personal, or just peculiar, we'll find out one phone call at a time.
As It Happens, where there's always a lot on the line.
And that's coming up this evening at 9 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. And tonight at 9 on Maine Public Television, we'll air Frontline, The Choice 2020, Trump versus Biden, a two-hour Frontline investigation into the lives and characters of Joe Biden and Donald Trump as they compete to be president. Those who know them best reveal key moments that made both men who they are today. That's Frontline tonight at 9 o'clock on Maine Public Television.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are talking with NASA astronaut Jessica Meir about her time in space, her return to Earth, and what it might be next for her. We invite you to be part of the conversation. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800 1-800-399-3566. Jessica, I've got to ask you about the big news about the evidence of water on the moon. What is your response to what NASA announced yesterday?
I think it's incredibly exciting, and it just shows all of the different missions that are being conducted right now, both robotically, with humans, and it's a great segue and great lineup for our Artemis missions. You know, NASA is currently planning the Artemis missions, which will send the first woman and the next man back to the surface of the moon. And so things like that, resources like water, may be a very critical part of our infrastructure there as we're generating and building this more sustainable, constant presence on the moon with a gateway system that will be in orbit around the moon with many missions to the surface of the moon. All these things come into play and will teach us so much more, not only about the moon, but also about the formation of the Earth and our entire solar system.
Any chance that first woman on the moon could be you?
Well, there's certainly a chance because I am one of the astronauts in the office right now. So I think there's a you know, we don't know for sure who it's going to be. If it were up to me, it will absolutely be me, but I don't have to make that decision. There's certainly a chance, and we'll have to see what unfolds. But I would just feel very privileged to play whatever role I can in that mission, whether it's supporting from the ground or one of the astronauts on the missions. And there'll be several missions as well. We'll have the Artemis mission will actually be an unmanned mission just to make sure that everything is A-okay with that spacecraft before we put people in it. Artemis 2 will actually take astronauts out around the moon, so it'll go past and beyond and around the moon even further than we went during the Apollo missions. And then with the Artemis 3 missions and beyond, that's when we'll actually be landing on the surface and conducting more of those regular operations. So really exciting trajectory ahead of us.
All right, I'm going to go to Ellery calling from Waterville. Hi, Ellery, go ahead. What is your question for Jessica Meir?
Oh, hello, and what an incredible show. I'd like to make a quick reference back to the home planet, though. Jessica mentioned earlier about looking up at the stars and how incredibly beautiful it is to look at the Milky Way. What is Jessica's perspective on looking back at the state of Maine on this glorious blue ball? Did you have time to really reflect on Maine's part in the perspective of all this grandeur?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of my favorite pastimes when we had any free time was to be looking out of the cupola windows and thinking about exactly that. And I can tell you that one of the most perspective-changing things is that feeling. You know, Frank White actually even wrote about it, called the overview effect, and how the human person and philosophy is really changed by seeing the planet from above. And I think, first of all, that's an appreciating, even more of an appreciation for how fragile our planet is and how we need to take care of it and keep it that way for generations to come. You know, when you look back at this fragile blue ball, this tenuous thin band of an atmosphere, you realize even more so that we need to protect it. It's truly such a gorgeous and special place. And the other thing is this feeling of interconnectedness. So whether I'm looking down at Maine or anywhere else, from space, you know, we don't see those man-made boundaries, all of these geopolitical separations that we've imposed on ourselves as humans. And you have this feeling of interconnectedness. Maine with all of the other states, with all of the other countries, these continuous land masses, continuous oceans. And you really have this perspective and appreciation that we are all connected. We are all one human, and we're truly all in this together. I had a lot of fond memories looking back at Maine and trying to capture some good pictures. Unfortunately, it's pretty cloudy a lot. So I did get some, though, and you'll have to look out for those. I'll be posting some on social media. But I absolutely did have everybody in Maine in my heart and in my thoughts while I was up there.
Ellery, thanks for your question. Jessica, one thing we haven't talked about yet is the fact that when you left, there was not a pandemic on this Earth, on this beautiful planet Earth. But when you came back, everything had changed. Talk about science fiction. What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, you're right. And we actually described it exactly that way, too, jokingly, of course. But when there were only three of us up there and we realized the magnitude of what was happening, we thought it sounded just like the beginning of a science fiction movie. When, you know, you pan to these three astronauts in the space station and the Earth is wiped out by something and it's just us left. And it did really feel almost that surreal because it was difficult to appreciate what was happening when we were so separate from it. And we were actually very busy with our mission. Nothing changed in terms of our mission objectives and workload. So we were very busy with it and had less time to process what was happening. And of course, we were still in touch with our family and friends and getting updates on the news. And it was just so strange to be looking down at this magnificent, beautiful earth that looked the same as it did the day before, but to realize what was unfolding beneath us. I launched in September of 2019, so as you mentioned, no thought of COVID, of course. And then we landed in the middle of April of this year, so really right in the thick of things here back in the U.S., and it was a lot to process. When Chris Cassidy, the other main astronaut, joined me on the space station, we overlapped only for about 8 days when he came up before we went home. But he actually sat my crewmate Drew Morgan and I down and said, well, I guess we didn't actually sit down. He talked to us because we were floating.
You floated? You were floating. Okay.
That's right. But he did say, you know, you guys really think about this because it's a really different planet. It's not, you know, this isn't just a small deal. Everything has changed. You need to prepare yourself mentally for what you're going back to, because he had, you know, kind of been on the flip side before he launched. And you know, now 6 months later, Chris just got back just last week, and he's back now too, and still back to this same very changed planet. So it was an interesting process for us to deal with, not just dealing with coming back from space after being gone for 7 months in my case, for 9 months for Drew's case, but now suddenly having to interpret this whole new world among it. It has certainly been an interesting process.
And how has the pandemic affected your work since you've returned to Earth?
Yeah, so right now at NASA, we're still mostly remote. You know, it was really interesting for us when we were in space. It was really a testament to how NASA rises to a challenge and can accomplish anything. You know, we were up there with it was a seamless transition for us. If we hadn't been directly told, we wouldn't have known what was happening. But here at NASA, of course, everything was drastically changed. They, in the Mission Control Center, they actually set up a second control room so that when people came to relieve each other for shifts, they didn't have to come in contact with each other and they could keep all of the teams safe. So that kind of thing has continued at NASA, where we've been staffing things remotely whenever possible. And if we need to do things in person, then we have all of these new enhanced COVID safety protocols in place. So we're trying to return to operations as much as we can, but do it safely. So we're taking this kind of phased approach like other government agencies. And right now I'm mostly working remotely, but then for things that I need to be in person for, we'll come in and, you know, have fewer people, have masks, of course, and have these enhanced safety procedures.
You know, and you have training in being in a very small space for a long time when just seeing a couple people. How is being what you might call in quarantine and the International Space Station the same or different than how we're living today in this country?
I would say how we're living today on the ground is much more difficult than being in space. And I think that's mostly because isolation and confinement are really just part of the mission for space. We know that. We're very well prepared for it. There's a very good reason for it. Through the window is the vacuum of space. And so we know why we are in that. And everything else is just so extraordinary. You're experiencing so many new and incredible things that for me, the isolation and confinement really wasn't an issue at all. You know, it's just part of the mission. I think for us on Earth, though, you know, our society is not built that way. And so it's much more challenging to deal with it when you can't go out and do things, you can't see people in the same way, you can't have those kind of interactions, which are very important for humans, and which our society just doesn't really sustain itself, you know, in that way. So for me, I find it much more challenging. Maybe if you're an extreme introvert, you're still happy in this new world. But for me as an extrovert and definitely as a hugger, it's been pretty difficult to come back from space for 7 months and not be able to hug and see everybody in the same way.
Tom on Facebook writes, take a moment to remember the first Mainer to touch the edge of space, Robert Rushworth of Madison, Maine, a pilot in the X-15 program 60 years ago. Well, Tom, thank you for that. I didn't know about that. Jessica, is this someone you're familiar with?
No, actually, I'm not familiar with that name. But yeah, there were several incredible pilots back in that program, really groundbreaking programs in terms of all the aircraft that were being developed to enable future space travel. So job well done, then. That's incredible.
And, you know, a lot of people are talking about the first all-female spacewalk outside the International Space Station. But I read also that you had the longest space flight by a woman. Is that true?
No, that wasn't me. That was actually my crewmate, Christina Cook. She was up there just due to some schedule changes with our flights on the Soyuz. She ended up being up there for 11 months, which she was happy do it. And yeah, so I was up there for 7 months. Christina was up there for 11.
Okay. Well, on that note, we are going to take another quick break. More calls and questions coming in. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you have something you'd like to ask Jessica Meir, call 1-800-399-3566. We have time for a brief email, talk@mainpublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the .olea team at RE/MAX Riverside, committed to providing an innovative real estate experience. 956-0866. And the Lunder Foundation, in support of the Colby College Museum of Art, who are bringing the museum to you online at colby.edu/museum.
The USS Portland arrived at Portland Harbor for Navy Day celebrations on October 27, 1945. In its extensive service, the vessel accrued 16 battle stars, making her one of the most decorated ships in the U.S. fleet. The USS Portland participated in the Battle of the Coral Sea, Midway, Tarawa, and Guadalcanal. Known to her crew as Sweet Pea, the ship withstood over 80 kamikaze attacks. Following World War II, the USS Portland was the setting for the Japanese surrender in the Caroline Islands. It was decommissioned in 1946 and scrapped by 1962. The cruiser's tripod mast is preserved at Fort Allen Park in Portland.
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Marshall Communications. Happy birthday, Maine!
I'm Tanya Mosley. A forensic team has unearthed nearly a dozen coffins as it searches for victims of the 1921 Tulsa, Oklahoma race massacre. It's estimated that well over 100 black people were killed in that massacre. We'll check in with a woman whose grandparents survived the violence. That's next time on Here and Now.
And that's coming up today at noon here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on our program, Jessica Meir, an astronaut and native of Caribou, Maine. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. An email from Richard. As a scientist and astronaut, I can imagine you spend a lot of time experiencing the logical and rational aspects. Throughout history, astronomy and spirituality have been linked in human experience. What were some of the spiritual experiences you had while in space?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think it relates a little bit to what we were talking about earlier with the overview effect. And I think another part, other than what I already described, is the feeling, the appreciation you have for really how insignificant we are as humans, such a small part of the planet, and the planet being such a small part of the solar system, an even smaller part of the universe. And you get a different kind of appreciation for that when you look down at the Earth below, and then you look all around it and behind you, and all you see is this void and the blackness of space and the stars around. And I think it does give you that kind of step back, that kind of enhanced perspective. And I think it's important for people. You know, I think as humans, we tend to get very caught up in the minutiae and sometimes the very trivial, unimportant details in life. And it's important to remember to take that step back and really appreciate and put things into perspective. And I think that vantage point, which I was fortunate enough to have, does kind of make that easier. It gives you that shift. But I would encourage people to try to do that on their own as well.
I'll go to Philip, who's calling from West Gardner. Hi, Philip. Go ahead.
Hi there. With no offense to Ms. Meir, who I respect her bravery and her excitement with what she does, I, for an engineer, have been watching the space program for over 50 years and consider it the biggest, most expensive boondoggle in human history since the pyramids, which were built to glorify men. Kennedy started the manned program to glorify men over the Russians because of Sputnik. And in what we should be doing is taking care of the climate on Earth, not looking after the climate of three or four astronauts in a space capsule. your 95% of your payload goes to keeping you alive up there.
All right. Well, Philip, I'm sure Jessica Meir has heard this before. Jessica, what's your response?
Yeah, I think you do have a good point, and you are right about Kennedy driving the Apollo program. There was certainly the reason why we did that was because of the Cold War and because of the space race. And without that kind of political motivation, we certainly would have never done it when we did. But I would argue for the fact of basic science and exploration that our space program is very much worth supporting. And if you take a look actually at our budget, it is really a very minuscule if you compare it to other things that our government is spending money on. I totally agree that we do need to spend more on the on science and regarding climate change, regarding everything to do with research on Earth, whether it's in the oceans or land-based systems. That is absolutely just as important and paramount. But I don't think that that funding needs to come from, for example, the NASA budget, which really is a very, very small portion of how we spend our money in the United States. And I think the tangible benefits from the program are real. Like I was mentioning earlier, the things that we're doing in space are, sure, it's very expensive to keep us safe and keep us alive when we're in space. But there are a lot of areas of research which we simply can't study on Earth with the gravity environment. And as I mentioned, a lot of those have direct tangible benefits to benefit life back on Earth. We're not just talking about astronauts and future space exploration. We're talking about disease states which are plaguing patients back here on Earth. We're talking about technologies that can enable things like different types of brain surgery. There are so many different spin-off technologies that have come from the applications from NASA experiments and hardware. So I would argue that it's still very much worth supporting, not only for curiosity and for exploration and for advancing men, as you mentioned, but I think also for these direct tangible benefits and for basic science as well.
Philip, thanks for your question. We'll move on to Wyndham and Kate. Hi, Kate. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for this wonderful program. Really appreciate it. Question for you is, I've heard so much emphasis on the first female spacewalk and so much emphasis on your gender in your profession, and I would just love to hear your reflection on that if you feel like that is really the appropriate emphasis, or also if you feel any responsibility with that emphasis, and just sort of what your how you identify with that.
Yeah, that's a great point, because I think for women in any successful or high-profile field, it is sort of multifaceted. And some people, you know, sometimes you do think, well, wait a minute, why are they just highlighting my gender? Shouldn't I just be highlighted for my achievements? You know, it's not because I'm a woman. It's the fact that we all had to work very hard to get here. And there is truth to that. But I think as we promote equity and as we make sure that everybody is represented right now, if we're still at the stage when we can inspire people and we can get children excited so that we do end up stimulating more women, more minorities in the STEM fields, and it's still moving in the right direction. I mean, I've certainly kind of gone back and forth how I feel about that too, sort of how I mentioned with the all-female spacewalk. In the beginning, I was like, well, what's the big deal? We're just doing our job. Why can't we just be celebrated for being competent and being successful in doing that? But at the same time, I think that historical significance is important to highlight, especially as a tribute to the women that pushed those boundaries before. But also, like we talked about earlier, for me, what I really hope for is the day when we're no longer highlighting the gender, because it's just normal to have everybody represented. And I think we're still moving in that direction, and I hope it comes within our lifetime, certainly for your kids if you have them, or all the kids that are still growing up right now.
Kate, thanks for that question. And that brings up, Jessica, I think part of the reason your spacewalk became a big deal is because there was a previous spacewalk that didn't happen. And my understanding that it didn't happen because there weren't any appropriate spacesuits. The whole spacesuit issue is a little more complicated than you might think, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. And that story was a little bit a different perspective that was presented in the media than the true version of the story, as often happens. But, you know, I think the underlying reason for that was that it's kind of this anachronism where we're tied to the past. So right now, NASA is developing new spacesuits, and those spacesuits are actually being built to accommodate smaller people, and then they're going to scale up from there, since that's an easier engineering approach. So we will have these spacesuits, which have a lot more mobility and dexterity, and will fit everybody much better than, say, the current spacesuit fits me right now. But the fact is, we're still tied to these spacesuits, given the way the NASA technology cycle and then also the budget cycle have played out in the last few decades, where the spacesuits that we're still using are the ones that were really designed back in the 60s and 70s. And so we're left with these same size range of spacesuits that better represent the community of astronauts in those early days, which were all sort of larger men. So now, you know, not as important whether or not you're a man or a woman. It's more kind of overall body size. And, of course, women are generally smaller than men, so it does seem to be more women that don't fit as well in the spacesuit. But we're still tied to that technology from decades ago just because of the way the program works.
And I was surprised that the spacesuits live on the station. It's not as though you get fitted back on Earth and you take that special suit with you up to the station.
Right, that's right. Spacesuits are incredibly expensive, and there are not that many of them, and we have to kind of use the ones that are already there. With the space shuttle program, they did used to fly them up and down regularly for those missions, but with the space station, we don't really have that capability. So we use the ones that are up there and ready, and what happened with that previous spacewalk was there was a medium and a large ready to go, and Anne had actually done some testing and runs on the ground in that large and thought that it would be okay, but after going out the hatch on her first spacewalks in a medium, she realized that it probably wasn't the best decision, and it would be better to use a different crew member that fit better in that suit for that particular spacewalk. And so even though we had another medium up there at the time, it wasn't configured and ready to go, and that would have required too much crew time, so it just didn't make sense operationally. It was just a decision, an operational decision, which is the kind of way that we have to always make the way that we run things in space in order to be successful. We have to have that operational mindset. So what we did after that was then react to the situation and realize, okay, we have now some smaller crew members that are going to be up there. Let's configure that medium spacesuit so that we have the option in the future to have two mediums. And that's exactly what we did to solve the problem. So that's what Christina and I were able to use that day.
We'll go to Paul, who's calling from Farmington, New Hampshire. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for a fascinating program, and to you, ma'am, for your many fabulous accomplishments. What do you folks breathe on the space station, and how is it generated?
Great question. Yeah, we are breathing air the same that you're breathing down here, so a mix of nitrogen and oxygen, and that is delivered in space in different ways. So it's a pressurized environment. We have about the same pressure that we have normal atmospheric pressure here. The nitrogen comes up in tanks and is resupplied on different progress vehicles. The oxygen we have in what's called the OGS, the oxygen generation system, so we can actually add more oxygen to the system. We can actually make some oxygen on board, but we also have oxygen tanks to supplement that.
Paul, thanks for your
question.
We have a fun question here from Lucy. I'm curious about her opinion of the show Away, about a team of astronauts who go to Mars. Has she watched it? And if so, how realistic is it in terms of how it portrays life on the ship?
I have watched Away, and I thought it was a great program. You know, NASA actually did some consulting for that, and Hilary Swank was here filming much of that sequence here at NASA. I actually was in space during one of her visits, and so I got to speak to Hilary from the space station when she was here, and that was really nice to have that connection. We were able to connect again after the fact as well. I think they did a great job with paying a lot of attention to detail, a lot of the small things. You know, we as astronauts could recognize that attention to detail with the different shirts that they were wearing or the different pieces of hardware or the food or the way that they had things arranged on the spaceship. You know, I think that it is a television drama, so there is a lot more drama involved than I think that we normally have in terms of our crew relationships. Usually we have that a little bit more dialed in because we know each other well in advance and we're very well trained in all of these expeditionary skills and how to get along. But of course it is true that that can happen, especially on an even longer duration mission like going to Mars. So I thought it was a great program.
Okay. Not a lot of drama on the International Space Station.
There's always some kind of drama in any setting with humans involved in a small confined space, of course, but, you know, not quite that level.
Not TV level. Jessica, it's so interesting to me that not only are you an astronaut, but you're also a marine scientist. And those are really the two great frontiers. And I'm wondering, I'm sure you've thought about the parallels between exploring, for example, parts of the ocean that are so deep no one's been to, as well as space.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, they both have this inherent connection that's always driven me in terms of exploration, in terms of an extreme environment, needing a life support system and going to places that we haven't necessarily gone or that few people have gone before. And all of those things are very, very appealing to me and very similar to my previous line of work where I was studying the physiology of animals in extreme environments. And it's almost like it's full circle now. I'm the animal in the extreme environment in space, and I kind of have paid my dues where I used to work at NASA previously as a scientist facilitating those experiments. Then I was doing my own experiments on animals, and now I'm really the animal that's the subject of all the experiments in space. So I think it's really come full circle with the end of my mission.
Well, speaking of being the animal in space, that's funny how you put that. Do you feel different now? Do you feel as though, can you sense a transformation in your body?
I think physically, not so much. You know, it does take some time to readapt to life with gravity. And in the beginning, it's not so fun. You literally feel like you're being pressed into the ground or pressed into your chair. You can actually sense that gravity since your body is just used to not having it. But after a few weeks, that kind of goes away. And after a few months, you do feel, I feel pretty much completely normal now. But I do think that perspective and that philosophical shift is something real. And hopefully that's something that I'll be able to attain, kind of what I was speaking to earlier.
All right. So you're back in the office now. What does that mean for you for the immediate future, Jessica? What's on your plate?
Yeah, well, I actually went back to work full time as of last week. And so getting reintegrated back into the office, recertifying for all the different training things that we have, like, for example, flying the T-38 jet or maintaining the CAPCOM certifications that I can help support from the ground in mission control. I actually have a run in the neutral buoyancy lab in the spacesuit on Thursday. So that'll be my first time back in the spacesuit. And I can tell you it's not going to be as much fun without gravity. It's going to be it's always a little bit harder down here. And then I'll be assigned a specific job on the ground supporting a different group or a different piece of hardware, that kind of thing. For example, maybe working for the exploration division, looking at the Artemis missions and our lunar and eventually Mars missions, or working to help support the commercial crew with SpaceX and Boeing or the spacewalk division. Basically, any division here at the Johnson Space Center, we have representatives in all of those. So I'm still awaiting what my assignment will be, but that should be coming pretty soon in the next couple weeks. And then I'll be back in line, hopefully, for another space mission in the future as well.
All right. And have you been able to be home in Maine at all since returning to Earth?
Well, COVID, of course, really disrupted a lot of my plans, but I finally couldn't go any longer without seeing my mother. So I was there not too long ago, actually, just a few weeks ago, I was there, and it was wonderful to be back in Maine and see the fall colors. Usually I'm there only in the summer these days, and so I was so happy to be back in my favorite season in fall. And it was a short trip, but it was, of course, wonderful to be back and see my mom, and that was an important part, I think, about reintegrating back on Earth.
Well, Jessica, thank you so much for spending an hour with us on Maine Calling. Jessica Meir, an astronaut with NASA, also a marine biologist, and she's from Caribou, Maine. Today's sound engineer was Lucy Suchek. This program will be rebroadcast at 7. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.